Hi, welcome to valuationpodcast.com, a podcast and video series about all things related to business and valuation. My name is Melissa Gregg, and I'm a valuation expert witness in St. Louis, Missouri. I have the pleasure of discussing pink collar crime, fraud, and embezzlement with Kelly Paxton, who is a private investigator and certified fraud examiner in Portland, Oregon, or I just learned, Bend, Oregon. Welcome, Kelly. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
You are such a powerhouse, a female powerhouse in all things having to do with fraud and forensics. But I think that where we should start, because I've already read a little bit about your background and you have a fascinating background. So how did you get into the fraud world or become a private investigator?
So it's kind of a crazy story. Like, I did not grow up wanting to be a cop at all. I started out at the Chicago Board of Trade. I became a stockbroker and a bond trader. And funny thing is we had a client who, his name is Alan, and he was kinky. And one day I was answering the phones at the brokerage firm and a woman called and she's like, "Do you know Alan?" And I was young. I kind of giggled. And she's like, "Why are you giggling?" I'm like, "Oh, is that his name today?" And she's like, "We're going to send a subpoena." Well, this was back before Know Your Customer and, you know, anti-money laundering regulations. And so we told Alan that someone was sniffing around and his money went immediately gone. She got him arrested and everything. About a year later, I called her up on the phone. I said, "I want to do what you do." I knew he was dirty. Sure enough, he had committed wire fraud. So it took about 6 months. And I became a federal agent for U.S. Customs in Seattle, Washington. And I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia, and I learned how to shoot guns. I had never touched a gun before in my life, drive cars fast, which I had done, but not get tickets. And then I arrested your typical bad guys, money launderers, drug dealers, pedophiles. And life happened. I ended up leaving customs because my husband got a job in the middle of the country. And we came back to Oregon and I started working as a sheriff's office as a certified fraud examiner, fraud analyst for their embezzlement team. And I started working regular Main Street embezzlement cases. So, and I found out that honest people steal and you know, who really steals well are women. So I Googled one day, women embezzlers, and the term pink collar crime came up. Now, pink collar crime is, the definition is petty amounts stolen by low to medium level employees, comma, primarily women from the workplace. So it's not like, Marcia Clark did a really cheesy show on CBS called Pink Collar Crimes. And she made it all about women committing any type of crime. So she completely got it wrong. It is garden variety embezzlement. And it's what women do really well because they're now in the workforce. So that I became the pink collar crime, AKA garden variety embezzlement expert. And I love it because we have the fraud triangle, which is opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. Women until the 1970s never had opportunity. Now they're in the workforce and they have opportunity. And women actually have financial pressures like they've never had before. Over 40% of women are primary breadwinners. So they have those financial pressures that men have had for, you know, generations. Now women have it. Women are just catching up to men in embezzlement. It's just women do it longer, but they steal less.
Interesting. I really hadn't thought about how prevalent women were in the workforce to be, to like make that connection of how they're now increasing in the crime. But you, so we've just talked about a whole bunch of terms that I don't know if people totally understand. Like, I think that in this space, people think that it's so glamorous, right? They think that you're an fraud investigator and you're a private investigator and this is like forensics and, you know, but like, if we step back a little bit, what is fraud in your words, in your terms? Like, when you picture it, what does it mean?
I consider fraud taking something that doesn't belong to you, but you've been entrusted with. So I primarily do embezzlement cases. Like I have done financial statement fraud. I have done corruption cases. But me as a solopreneur, I do primarily embezzlement cases on Main Street. Now, fun fraud fact here. I'm all about fun fraud facts. 3 out of 5 dentists get embezzled. So the next time you go to your dentist, after they've stuck their hand in your mouth and you got the Novocaine, ask them, so I've heard this crazy statistic that 3 out of 5 dentists get embezzled. And if they're quiet, they're one. And, you know, so more than 1 out of 2, my own dentist has been embezzled. So I consider fraud, you've been put in a position of trust and you take that trust and you steal. So garden variety embezzlement, you take something that isn't yours and it's cash or, you know, we don't relate to Bernie Madoff. So if you see the term white collar crime, people think of Bernie Madoff. And you know what? Unfortunately, people don't really feel badly for Bernie Madoff's victims. They think they're just a bunch of millionaires who got, you know, ripped off. Well, that's not true. That is true, but there's also a lot of people who were devastated financially by it. But we don't relate to Bernie because he didn't live by us. He lived on the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side of New York. He traveled by private plane. He had a home in the Hamptons. We didn't see him. But embezzlement is committed by people that live amongst us. Like Kevin Bacon's 6 degrees of separation with embezzlement, it's 1 or 2 at most. I can go to a party and I can start talking to people. And I'm going to tell you, everyone has a 1 or 2 degree relationship to someone or some organization that has been embezzled.
Well, and so that's interesting because if we're talking about fraud and we're talking about fraud and embezzlement, are they the same thing? Like what is embezzlement then to you in some capacity?
So embezzlement is just taking, I'm going to say smaller amounts of cash. Whereas like when you consider the whole term of fraud, you're thinking like Enron, you're thinking Bernie Madoff, you're thinking huge things that people, again, really don't relate to. But embezzlement is stealing, you know, it can happen at a Fortune 50. I mean, I worked at a Fortune 100 company and embezzlement happened there. But it's embezzlement is also what I call the relatable crime because it's the crime that happens where we live. And we don't pay attention to Enron or we say it's not going to happen to us. And truth be told, white collar crime, which pink collar is kind of a subset of, it happens to you more often than a street crime. So just in the last 2 years, I have been a victim of pink collar crime twice. My water district was ripped off to the tune of $202,000 by that trusted office manager. She actually ended up committing suicide. So it became a red collar crime. But then I just found out that my private investigator license, I have to have insurance for. And it turns out for 3 years, I bought an insurance policy through a company. And I just saw in the news like a week ago that the owner of the insurance agency was taking in premiums and not doing the policy. She stole, allegedly, she has not been convicted yet, $750,000. And it wasn't during the time frame I had a policy there. But like, so that insurance company was also ripped off by, you know, a trusted employee. Well, she was the owner of the company. Apparently she had a gambling habit, which we can talk all day long about gamblers who embezzle.
Well, because that, you know, like it's, as you talked about the fraud triangle, that comes into play. If you're looking at some, you know, like you could have, well, right now we're, you know, everybody's probably experiencing a little bit of hardship, right? And so you could just have hardship that falls on you that creates the need for the money. But the other issue that, you know, first thing that you start looking at, do they have a substance abuse issue? Do they have a gambling issue? Are their fancy car, you know, like, are they making $30,000, but driving a Range Rover, you know, like things like that, that don't make sense, I think are always going to trigger somebody. But those are usually some of the red flags, right? But I think, and you kind of touched on it a little bit about the pink collar crime and what it is, but I want to go into more depth in it because I think that we don't always understand in this women's role. So pink collar crime is, that you've already kind of talked about, is really women stealing in some capacity or taking money, right?
Well, so I'm known as the fraud hashtag queen. And the reason we talked earlier about this hashtags, I do hashtags so I keep track of what I put out for content wise. But so one of my favorite hashtags is hashtag it's position, not gender. The thing is women are in 90%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, of bookkeeping positions are filled by women. So a man can be a pink collar criminal. It's just women are in the lower level positions. And those are the positions that are in the weeds, and they see every dollar going into a business and every dollar going out of a business. So a man can be a pink collar criminal, but women do it, I'm going to say, more often because they're in the lower level positions, and that's where the money is flowing through a business. So you can have a chief financial officer who literally can't even do a journal entry or, you know, write a check, but every accounts payable or accounts receivable has access to that money. So that's why I say it's position, not gender. And you know what? To be honest, I get women who push back on my title of pink collar crime. They're like, you're picking on women. And I'm like, the bigger issue is the fact that women are in lower level positions. That's an issue that I can't fix. I did not come up with the term pink collar crime. It actually was popularized in 1989 by Dr. Kathleen Daly. And that was the definition, low to medium level employees, who's primarily women, who steal from the workplace. Mm. And so I didn't make it up, but it's stuck. It's just it, like, I've tried to say I'm the embezzlement expert, but people are like, I have a woman who always, she'll tag me on social media and she's like, hey, Pink, what do you think about this story? So I can't get away from it. But that's the other thing is, like, at the core of me, I really believe that good people make bad choices. Mm-hmm. And we worked a case where a woman stole over $100,000 from her kids' own school. And the detective who worked the case with me, she said it was one of the saddest days of her law enforcement career was arresting this woman. And I think, yeah, I'm kind of here to break the stereotype of criminals. Like, we grow up saying bad guys. We also, when you were little, or if you have children, you tell your kids, if you get lost in the store, look for the nice lady to help you find me. Mm-hmm. And if a bad guy comes up, run or scream. Like, just because someone looks nice doesn't mean they can't steal. Mm-hmm. So I kind of am breaking the stereotype, but not in a bad way, because, like, the fraud triangle, people have pressures. And with COVID, the pressures are just, we've never seen pressures like this. So fraud's going to increase.
But let's go back, because I think it's an interesting point, because most people, I think, have this perception that if a, like, let's say somebody's stealing from a company, okay, embezzling from a company, their first thought may be, well, it's the president, it's the vice president, it's the officers, it's the this. But the reality is, like you just pointed out, is that it's typically those people are just sort of like randomly maybe they're probably not even signing checks. They're probably just, and they might not even look at it. Like, you might have a CFO or something. It's really the people that are handling the checks coming in, they're processing it and putting it in. And that's where we get to kind of an accounting term, which is separation of duties. You know, and everybody's like, oh, why does everybody talk about separation of duties? That's so ridiculous. But it's because in a lot of these smaller businesses, family businesses, they're going to be really particular about hiring like an accounting firm, right? That's a, you know, like, we got to make sure that accounting firm. But the reality is they're not going through the same level of detail when they're hiring the internal bookkeeper or the cousin's brother's sister's daughter that took an accounting class and she's going to, you know, handle the books. Like, let's talk more about the profile, not just women and men, not just gender, but the typical profile of somebody who does commit some fraudulent act. are they hardened criminals that have been doing this forever?
No. So according to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, only 4% of fraudsters have a criminal history. Another statistic, and statistics in white collar crime are really, really messy. If you have a murder, you have a dead body. But if you have a white collar crime, you might have, you know, financial statement fraud or embezzlement or wire fraud. It's really, really messy. And they say only 15% of all embezzlement cases get turned over to law enforcement. There's lots of reasons for that. The number one reason is shame and humiliation. I can show you business owners all day long who are embarrassed by the fact that they didn't see it. I tell the story a lot, and it's a colleague of mine, and she was doing an investigation for a business. She dumped all the data, and then the business owner said, okay, I'll tell you who has what responsibilities. And he goes around, and he's like, okay, this person, he gets to his administrative assistant, and he says to my friend, he goes, oh, don't look at anything Sally does. She's too stupid to steal from me. Guess who stole? Mm-hmm. Sally. Now, if I were there, I would have said, Sally, let's go to Neiman Marcus, and I'm going to really show you how to steal. So, I mean, I'm being very facetious, but that sort of attitude, it never, ever gives a person a reason to steal. But again, you have the fraud triangle with opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. You're giving them rationalization. So most fraud professionals will say the thing you control for is opportunity. That's the easiest thing to control for. You put internal controls in, you button everything down, but
cameras in. Yeah. All of the things that people know. Right.
Yeah. But rationalization, if you treat your employees like she's too stupid to steal from me, again, never a reason to steal, but you're chipping away at what their loyalty to you, and the rationalization becomes much, much easier. So,
it's kind of like it's easier to steal from a jerk than if you like the place that you work. But even then, even if you like the place, you've been longest employee, because I did a lot of government fraud or schools and things like that. And was always the city manager that was like this upstanding citizen, would never hurt, harm, or do anything, but either falls on hard times, has a bad habit, something starts happening, and they start taking it little by little, right? Because we're always going to pay it back. We're just going to take a little bit. I mean, like, I just need to pay my mortgage so I don't lose my house. So I'm going to just take like $1,000 or maybe $1,500. But next, when I get paid, I'm going to pay it back. I'm going to put it back in there, and no one's even going to know. And that's what kind of starts the cycle of, you know, so it's not like these people sit back and they scheme, like, how am I going to take $500,000 from this person? It could start as $50. It could start as $100, but the payback never happens. And you gave a good example on your blog, I think, that you were talking about how somebody got found out because they had to have a surgery and they had to take time off. You know, those are the internal controls, put in cameras, mandatory vacation so that you can figure things out. But the rationalization is that if you know, in some people's mind, if you have more than me, then you're not going to miss it. And if this guy continues to talk like, oh, you're too stupid to steal, you're like, ha ha. I guess you don't care. I guess you don't, you're not noticing or something like that. So I think that's a really interesting area.
I have a woman who stole, the first time it was $10. She worked for a school district in Wisconsin and she was not even making $11. And when she was sentenced, I believe she got 3 years, she had stolen $350,000. And she said, quote, it was $10 the first time. No one noticed. There's a guy who was a superintendent, Frank Tassone, of the Roslyn Long Island School District in New York. And it was one of the highest performing public school districts in the country. And the case is kind of old, but they made a movie on HBO called Bad Education. And I would recommend watching it. They did a really good job. But he was interviewed on a podcast because he's out. He's, you know, and unfortunately for the state of New York taxpayers, he's still getting $170,000 a year in pension He's paid back his restitution, which is unusual. But he said that it started with two Greek salads and two sodas. And he showed up Monday and no one noticed. He ended up stealing over $2 million.
Wow.
So literally two Greek salads and two sodas and no one noticed.
And well, it, yeah.
Not so many times. And to go to the rationalization, another part of it is I can show you an astronaut, a rocket scientist, a neurosurgeon, Mark Cuban. He was ripped off. It doesn't matter how smart you are or where you are on the org chart and they're down here. It's all about the opportunity and the access. So Mark Cuban was embezzled. He had $84,000 in the bank. He had just graduated from the MBA program at, I believe, Indiana University. He thought he did everything right. He wrote the checks out. He signed them. He handed them to his assistant, Renee, and he said, put them in the envelopes and, you know, mail them. Well, Renee was nice enough to leave him $2,000, but she took white out and she just covered the name of the vendor to pay to the order of. And he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him because he said it would never happen again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so embezzlement's never a great thing to happen, but I can show you examples where like it happened kind of small and it didn't happen to him again, because once it happens to you, generally speaking, it's not going to happen to you again, with the exception of dentists. I've had several dentists who has happened to them several times. They don't.
Well, and I think that creates kind of, you know, where do you not see it? You know, does fraud happen in all industries, all types of companies? Do you see any prevalence? And I mean, obviously, cash-based businesses, you're going to see more of. But what about other industries?
So I love LinkedIn and I think that's how we met, but I did this and I love putting content out there because, and I like to make it fun because if you remember, you're going to remember it because it's funny. And so I did a stump the embezzlement jock like this last summer, and it was name an industry that hasn't been embezzled and I'll send you like it was a coffee cup. And oh my God. So the person who won was a lawyer, darn it. And it really, I think he pushed the envelope. Snake wranglers. Now, there is no snake wrangling association, so I don't technically think that that's an industry, but every industry, circus performers, rodeo, like every industry, it happens. And yeah, certain industries it happens more in than others, but just because, like, say you're in, you know, rocket ship building doesn't mean it can't happen to you because you have a bunch of rocket scientists. I would say it might happen to you more because you're way up here and you don't think about the stuff down in the weeds. So it can happen in any industry. Wherever there is money, embezzlement, pink collar crime can happen. All it takes is money.
Well, and you were saying only 15% gets reported, which is interesting to me, but also the reality is, can all fraud be detected, determined, quantified, proven?
Well, like you said about cash is the hardest because it's kind of like white collar crime statistics. You're trying to prove something that you don't really know for sure. So cash is really the hardest, you know, you're in valuation and it's like, there's averages or it's like, you know, okay. So for the rolling 30-day average, we were taking in this much cash, say it's 10x, and now we drop to 1x. Well, but the cops, that's why cash is really, really hard, because cops need to see cash. Mm-hmm. And they need to see the money going somewhere. So what's interesting about these cases, and like, okay, I am not nearly as smart as you because I can barely figure out EBITDA, but like these cases are, and I heard someone describe it as old school. They're old school. Money is here in the business and it goes here to the suspect. It doesn't go to Panama. It doesn't go to Liechtenstein. It doesn't go to cryptocurrency. And then here, like it goes from here, maybe to a gift card to here. These are paper cases. They are just document intensive paper cases, and cops do them. And unless you're an IRS agent, a cop doesn't become a cop to play with pivot. Like it's just, you know, we have to keep it kind of simple, and the money's here and it goes here. And that's why cash is really hard, because people don't generally put cash in their accounts. They just spend it. With COVID, it's a little different because like a lot of places aren't taking cash during COVID. Mm-hmm. But I'm watching The Sopranos right now because, you know, we're binging during COVID. And, you know, listening to Tony Soprano talk about Cash and him seeing it, I'm like, Cash is hard. Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard. So, yeah.
Well, and I think some of it's just not traceable. You know, some of it, you could spend a lot of time, effort, money, but you can't prove it. And I think that that's where it takes some, like, it really does take somebody kind of wanting to prevent fraud to come in and say, okay, where are the opportunities? Where are the areas that were something could happen? And then how do we stop it? Because those are the areas that everybody needs to focus on, but they don't, you know, because they have like this trust, like a lot of people rely on trust. And I don't think that business and trust should always mix. But I also have a theory that in times of trouble, so like if you look at any times like 2000, 2008, now, you're going to see a huge uptick in fraud. Why? Because when everybody's making money, no one's paying attention. And now when every dollar matters, they'll be like, wait a second, where did the dollars go? You know, they could have been missing for 5 years, but now all of a sudden everybody's paying attention because dollar money is tight. Business is tight. Things are dropping down. Expenses are still there. But nobody always talks about that. So in times of issue, you have a fraud that you now find out. What do you have to do as a business owner to, okay, so my employee stole from me. Now what? Do I have to file something? Do I have to go to my insurance company? Do I have to investigate this? Like, those are kind of the unknowns from a business owner.
Yeah. So, you know, what's funny, another hashtag, trust is not an internal control. Trust is really smushy. But yeah. Like, so say you find you think there's an embezzlement. This is like the latest sort of thing that I say is you walk into your house and you find a dead body. Are you going to touch it? No. You're going to like call 911 as you're running out the house or the office. But someone might think that something's going wrong and they're going to dig in all sorts of stuff. You're touching a crime scene. Mm-hmm. Like, and you have to understand that. So I had a woman recently who owned a business, $500,000 embezzlement. And she found me via pinkcollarcrime.com. And it turns out she kind of lived by me. And so we got to meet in person. And so I'm talking to her and I said, well, you could hire me. And she's like, why would I hire you? And she's like, the cops are going to do everything. And then I have an attorney who's going to do everything. And I'm like, okay, so the attorney costs way more than I do. It's just FYI. And the cops, you know, it's not always this way, but I worked for a big corporation and the cops got tired of like prosecuting employees behaving badly at the big corporation. They're like, if you can't manage your own employees, tough luck. We've got dead bodies to do. There are limited resources. And like, because I have a law enforcement background, I can go on behalf of a business to a law enforcement agency and sell a case because you know what? Sometimes, truth be told, the cops, they're not going to care. They're going to say this is civil. Like a lot of times law enforcement will say this is a civil matter. Let your attorney handle it when it's not a civil matter. But you have to educate them as to why it's not a civil matter. Now, I had the fortunate, you know, opportunity to work at a law enforcement agency that understood a lot of stuff was criminal and not civil. But you go to like, you know, a smaller law enforcement agency, they're going to say, this sounds like a business dispute. Go hire a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can bridge that gap. So the woman's like, well, no, I don't think that I need to hire you. Well, you know, I'm still talking to her and I'm basically saving her money because she's not having her attorney learn on the job. Because do you want to pay 2X or do you want to pay X? And I do this all day long. Mm-hmm. So when I get a business owner who's been ripped off, there are shortcuts and there are things that are reasonable. The other thing is I'm kind of a fraud therapist. Like they're really upset. They are unlike Bernie Madoff, who Bernie didn't have a lot of engagement with his victims. These are people that have been in your office sometimes for decades. It's like a marriage gone really, really bad. And they're also like, how did I not see it? And then you second guess yourself. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of this fraud therapist. And I did this presentation a long time ago. A dentist had been embezzled $1 million over 10 years. And he and his wife, you know, went through the process. I helped them. And the wife and I did a presentation together. And I said, okay, you need your attorney. This is your fraud team. You need your attorney. You need a CFE forensic accountant. You may need a computer forensics. You need law enforcement. And then she's like, excuse me, can I add something? And I was like, sure. And she's like, you need a therapist. And she goes, hardest thing she and her husband had ever been through. Because you know what? He's like, why didn't you see this? And she's like, why didn't you see this? And so, I mean, I joke I'm a fraud therapist, but I've seen it so many times. And it's not like a pattern, but there's grief. There is grief. There is depression. And the best thing a business owner can do when they find an embezzlement is to hire the right people and to get back to work. Because you know this, we're not cheap. Mm-hmm. But you've got to be able to make money to pay us because if you know,
yeah,
it's hard. I've had cases where it's going to put them out of business. And I'm like, you know, how can I charge them when it's going to put them out of business? And it's like, it's really hard to do it, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that one of the things that you said that I thought was super interesting is that you can go and sell the case, like you can see the case and you can go talk to law enforcement about it being criminal as opposed to civil. But like, what else can you help as, you know, as a certified fraud examiner with a business that has been embezzled? What else can you do? Because some of it could be covered by insurance, right? Some of it is relying upon police or something like that to do it. This is a lot of math and calculations and digging and putting it together. And you might have to testify, right?
Okay. Well, this is like, knock on wood. I've only testified in grand jury and I had an attorney. We worked a case for 3 years and like a year into it, he's like, well, you've testified, haven't you? And I'm like, nope. And he's like, you were given to me as an expert. And I'm like, yep. And I said, this case won't go to trial. And he goes, you don't know that. And I'm like, yeah, I do. And he's like, no, you don't. He was really upset. And I'm like, it's not going to go to trial. Like and I said, I always work a case like it's going to go to trial, but it hasn't. And so sure enough, 3 weeks before we were supposed to go to trial, what happens? It settles. The cases are generally, if law enforcement doesn't overreach, and sometimes law enforcement does overreach. I've done prosecution and I've done criminal defense, and I love criminal defense work. I love it all day long because there is nothing more important than keeping an innocent person from being prosecuted. And it happens. It truly happens. So I have this great story. I have a friend, she and her husband are uber successful, multimillionaires. He meets me. I grew up with her. He meets me and he finds out what I do. And he's like, phew, I'll never have to hire you. And I'm like, oh, really?
Famous last words.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, I pay well. I hire really good people. And I'm scary. He's not Tony Soprano scary, but he's scary. And I said, yeah, yeah, whatever. Fast forward 18 months later, guess who calls? It's the wife saying he's on the phone. He's like, 9 o'clock, my office tomorrow morning. So I get there and lawyers are there. I get there. He's a very public person. And he wants, and it was a man, but he committed a pink collar crime because he had a raging gambling problem. The client was very, you know, public, and he wanted this guy to be hung in the town square. Like he's like, and this is where the fraud, what comes in. I said, you know, Mr. X, Mr. Master of the Universe, settle down. If this gets in the newspaper, what is going to happen to your reputation? I said, we will get it prosecuted. We will get him arrested, but it's going to be quiet because the type of business he was in, his sort of colleagues and his investors would think less of him that this happened. Now, it was a one-off. It was kind of a crazy business deal that the guy found, you know, this closed bank, or it was an open bank account that was supposed to be closed. So it really was a one-off, but it came out, you know, in the newspaper like 18 months later in an LLC that now, if you're a journalist, you could track it back, but it was very important. He wanted absolute justice for to happen, and he got the justice. But I said, you have to be careful about your name being attached to this. And he's like one of my biggest proponents because it would have caused a lot of PR for him, mm-hmm. a lot of PR. And so that's where the fraud therapist in the selling of the case. What if you're a nonprofit and you get ripped off? I mean, I had a nonprofit who saw my presentation, realized that they were getting ripped off, and their lawyer said not to go to law enforcement. I was enraged because people are going to find out. And, you know, so there are ways to soften it or to be very strategic about the investigation.
Oh, well, I think that it's a big deal because if you become really public about somebody stealing from you, they kind of look at you and say, well, what did you do? Like, why didn't you prevent this from happening? And then the customers kind of think it's their money, right? Like, you're losing my money. How can I trust that you're paying attention? So it really does. But you have that revenge, you know, like somebody took something from me. And I want revenge, or I want them to pay, you know, like I want them to be hurt, like I'm hurt by it, but that doesn't always really equate to being helpful for your business.
Well, that's another thing is victim shaming. So I have a couple soapboxes, and that's another one is that victim shaming. I mean, so this woman who lost $500,000 was stolen. The story eventually comes out. And like our local paper, you can't do comments for stories, but they put it on like Facebook's page and people can comment there. You can't imagine the mean comments about a victim. They're like, how are they so stupid that they lost $500,000? How are they so stupid that, you know, they lost $1 million? And what people don't understand is it can happen to them. And it's a really terrible feeling. Like, if you go home today and your house is broken into, people are probably going to feel sorry for you. They're not going to say, God, you're stupid. Did you not turn on your burglar alarm? Or did you leave your door unlocked by any chance, Melissa? Or was your window open? Mm-hmm. They won't do that. But if money walks out of a business, they're going to go, okay, not so smart. It's like they don't know it until it happens to them. Like we would... I mean, this is a terrible, terrible example, but back in, you know, a long time ago, when say a woman was sexually assaulted, they would say, what were you wearing when it happened? That should have nothing to do with whether someone was assaulted or not. Should have nothing to do with it. Whether, you know, but it's, we have optimism bias. We think I'll be addressing, you know, because I primarily speak and train on this, but I'll be addressing a group of masters of the universe and they'll sit back and they'll go, he's probably going to get ripped off because he's not as smart as me. And it's like, really, dude? Like, we think it's going to happen to someone else. We never think it's going to happen to us. And that's a good thing that we are positive, but you also have to be very realistic.
Well, and sometimes, you know, because I've interviewed kind of other people that do different types of fraud. And I'm like, you know, maybe I'm just desensitized to it. Because, you know, people will be like, oh, I got to be careful entering my PIN number at the gas station. Oh, I got to be careful with my debit card. And I'm like, all that stuff can be stolen in a moment, in 2 seconds. Like, you'll know, whatever you envision is how it could happen is not going to be how it could happen. And it's going to be probably even like more right under your face. But the whole point is that when you are making money and other people need it, you know, there's always going to be an opportunity. Then you layer in the cash. But I mean, and we're talking about specific types of fraud. You know, there's other fraud of just defrauding the IRS and not saying you received enough income. Like we see a lot of famous people go for wire fraud and money fraud and all of these are mail fraud, when it's really you're defrauding the IRS. You got money from somewhere and you didn't tell them and you didn't report it back and now you're in trouble. You know, so there's a lot of ways that it can be shaped up. But I think it's an equal opportunity. And that's where that profile of a fraudster becomes really important. A lot of them are first-time offenders. A lot of them, you know, are not going to have a background check or something that that triggers you to know about it. But the reality is, even people who perpetuate crimes over and over, nobody's paying attention. Like you could at this point, you could Google people's names and you might be able to see they were arrested for something, and you might not hire them. But I think that people aren't paying as much attention until we get to times like this. You know, if you're making money hand over fist, I'm not looking at everything. If you're not paying people to look at it, then nobody's, you know, and everybody's trying to get away. I mean, how many times have you accidentally walked out of a store and you had an extra, like, my kids have done this sometimes where they're like, they're holding something. Did you pay for it? You know, well, what does that mean? Like, how easy was that? There's cameras, there's all these people checking. And yet we were easily able to walk out with a can of soda or something like sitting right there. What if people really want to commit crimes and they have a plan, you know, or as they start to do a little bit here and there, the opportunities start to open up because now they're looking for them. They're like, well, I stole some over here. Where else is there an opportunity? You know,
so many cases start with just like, you know, $10 out of the till. And then it's like, ooh, well, I had this crazy, crazy case when I worked for a big company and the employee had put makeup on the company credit card. And that was what triggered sort of, you know, we called it a fraud it, but, and then makeup went to, you know, oh, she was like padding the expense report. And then it went to, well, she came home from a business trip, but she, you know, stopped in Mexico to see friends. And because there was a stop, we had this policy with first class versus, you know, just regular class. And she just all day long. And then it was really unfortunate because, you know, we interviewed her and her boss got really, really upset. And then like a month later, she goes and she fills up her car with gas, which is in violation of the policy. You can charge mileage. And we're like, go to her boss. What's this? And she goes, well, we actually saved money by filling her tank of gas instead of having her do mileage. And I'm like, that's not the policy. Like, you know, any way she could find a way to steal, she would steal. And I will tell you, she's still working there. Her boss has been fired, but she's still working there. And she's probably grifting every which way but Sunday.
We had a great one where it was a small town and they were issuing business licenses on, do you know those like labels? Like we're all getting ready for holiday greeting cards. You know, the labels that you put your little address on? Legit, they just would take that label and it would have a number on it. And they would give that label to the person and put it on your little business thing. And so these people would come in with like $35 or $50 for their year business license. She'd give them a label. And so, you know, all the labels, and they would handwrite, you know, so here's all the labels. So they're handwriting these numbers on it. She just went and took the blank labels and would duplicate the number. So literally, in order for us to really go after her, we would have had to go to all the business locations, check the label against what they paid. And, you know, at some point it was like, I don't, you know, at what point do you just decide to fire the person, end that process, come up with a different process and move on when it's just too hot, it's too hard or cost prohibitive to actually analyze and quantify that loss.
And I think that's a really funny story. There was in Florida where Florida is like ground central for fraud or ground zero for fraud. Strippers have to pay a license fee. Do strippers like have bank accounts? No, they came in with like, you know, $2 bills just stuffed.
Yeah.
And the woman stole, I can't remember how many thousands of dollars. Like, okay, stealing from strippers, like, come on. This is but yeah, so because, and are strippers going to complain? No. Are they going to go into law enforcement and say, hey, it turns out that my license that I paid for with a bunch of $2 bills is not valid. Like, strippers don't really want to go to law enforcement, generally speaking.
Well, and here's the thing is the business owners did not know that their licenses were invalid. I mean, because they paid somebody, why, you know, and it, I mean, it's just fascinating that there's so many ways that can be done. But I think an interesting nuance that people may not know is that as a CFE or a certified fraud examiner, if you can't actually go and testify that somebody stole.
Nope.
Talk more about that. Because I don't think people get it. Like, we don't go in and say, hey, Sally stole $5,000. Put her in jail. Like, how does that really happen?
I had a case. And like I said, I've done prosecution and defense. And I think that, like, I have a colleague who says he'll only do prosecution. And I say that's really short-sighted. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that. So we don't say that this person stole money. We say there was $100,000 in the business and $100,000 in the exact same amount of checks ended up in Sally's account. That's just, you know, money here, money there, whether it's fraud or theft or like, no, our code does not allow us to do guilt. So we say the money was here and it went here. And it's up to the jury to decide if that is, you know, fraud.
Yeah.
And some attorneys don't understand that. Like, I had an attorney who I did a little prelim on a case for him. And he called and he got referred to me because I had done a hotel embezzlement case and it was, you know, similar industry. And he goes, so can you testify this week? And I was like, no. And he's like, what are you talking about? You're an expert. And I'm like, okay, first off, these cases go for a really long time. And second off, you know, I can see on social media that your client has a raging gambling issue. And if the prosecutor asks me any question down this field, I have to answer truthfully. I'm like, you need to get the best plea deal that there is. He goes, you can't say she's guilty. And I said, I didn't say she's guilty. I'm just saying if the prosecutor asks certain questions, I have enough information to say yes or no to. Mm-hmm. And he was so upset with me. And I was just like, you know, you need to understand that, like, you need a plea deal. Like, it's not looking good for her based on the limited evidence that I saw that you provided with me. Yeah, she's got a raging gambling issue. And the money went into her account. So you need to don't go to trial. Like, no lawyer wants to lose. So I just was like, no, I won't be, you know, I'm not going to say something that is like not going to help the client, period. Like,
yeah, it's kind of like if it quacks like a duck, you want me to go in and say it's a frog. Like, I can't do that. But I just think it's really interesting because, you know, we do all this work and we kind of support a conclusion, which is, you know, somebody did, money was here, it's gone, it now is over here the next day. And we're saying, hey, judge, can you connect from here to there? Because that's what has to happen, because stealing or theft are legal terms. And that is really a legal conclusion. And we're not coming in for a legal conclusion. We're coming in to show really just the evidence. We're, you know, in a lot of respects, we're just saying, here's the evidence for it was over here. Here's some things that we can see, the whiteout on the checks, you know, different type of schemes, if you will. We call them all schemes. But it's very interesting. But I think you brought up something that I thought was also interesting, is that you have, you know, some ideas of how you can be proactive when you're selling a business. And if you're the buyer, how, you know, how can you not be concerned that there's a fraud that's taken place if you're coming in and to look at this business?
So we talked about this a little bit before the show, but I have this colleague who does documentation. So she'll go in and she'll do from A to Z, all your business processes. I call this a sort of getting hit by the bus book. I've always had it wherever I work. So if for some reason I can't come in, someone can go to my desk and know exactly what I need, they need to do to keep the business running. I think if you're a business owner and you're going to sell a business, and I've worked a lot of cases where, you know, the sales go south. They're like, the buyer comes in and says, you know, you didn't have 10X in sales. You only had 5X in sales. And it's like, if it's all documented in advance, I think it's like a very inexpensive insurance policy, because you can say, this was in my book, like that our sales every year are 5X and this year it was 10X. But this was a one-off, or, you know, we only have a contract for so many years or something like that. I think if you document it, it protects you as the seller, because no one wants to hire attorneys after you've gone and retired and, you know, you moved to Florida with your boat and everything like that. And all of a sudden the buyer comes back and says, or the buyer's attorney comes back and says, your numbers weren't good and you falsified stuff. If you have documentation showing all of your processes, you can say, no, if they had read, you know, subsection 3B, they would see that this contract expired in, you know, whatever. I just think it's really like, it's so important that you document things so they can't come back to you. Mm-hmm. You know, family disputes, there's family disputes where it's like, you didn't disclose this. I can't get out of bed in the morning if I think people are always out to get me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, I don't think people are out to get me or get people, but people think money solves everything. Mm-hmm. They just think money solves everything. And the more of it, the better. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when the buyer doesn't get as much as they thought, the first thing they think of is, I'm going to sue. Mm-hmm. They lied. And it's mm-hmm. like, if you have documentation showing everything and not leaving stuff out, I think you're protected. So I've worked with business brokers, and when they heard about this, because I got all excited for it, because I was kind of like, why wouldn't you do this? I mean, you should have it, because, like, especially COVID, God forbid, what if you have an employee who gets sick and dies from COVID, and they have the keys to the kingdom? What do you do? Mm-hmm. Like, do you know how to get into, you know, your ERP? No, mm-hmm. that person did, or they're in the hospital, or they're intubated. Like, you have to know how everything works. And you, as the business owner, the buck stops with you. So right. Be proactive.
Well, and I know that when we've done valuations for companies who are selling, or buyers that are looking like, oh, is this a reasonable price? I remember we had a client once, and we started to do the analysis and show him like what the valuation looked like. And he was like, what are these numbers? We're like, those are the, you know, whatever it was, the financial statements or the tax returns. He was like, oh, those aren't the right books. he's like, where did you get those from? Because I don't think that those are the right books. There's a different set of books. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me, right? Like, you're kidding me. Like, I don't need, like, stop talking. Stop talking. Because, you know, another interesting thing in the valuation world, and it used to be in the accounting world too, is that in our engagement letters and everything, we say, we're not coming in to detect fraud. I'm not going to do analysis deep enough to, you know, like, we do ratios and stuff, which you will sometimes uncover that there's something weird going on. But we don't go to the level of trying to detect and determine the fraud or quantify the fraud. But clearly, if somebody's going to sit me down in a meeting and say, you have two different sets of books, you've now raised the red flag, fraud flag, And now I'm like, okay, well, you know, stop talking. I'm not involved with this anymore. Like, I don't know where to go because I can't provide evaluation based on bad numbers, you know, those types of things. But they just thought it was normal. They're like, oh, well, some things we just don't put in there.
Well,
okay.
I had a friend, longtime family friends, brother and two sisters, the brother's buying out the two sisters, and you know, they have a good relationship. And so when they go to do the buyout, they're cheap and they get one valuation expert, even though, you know, your brother buying the business and the two sisters getting, you know, the buyout, and one sister's older and she's like, yeah, it's so expensive. Those people, they're so expensive. Let's just share. Well, okay. He had two sets of books. And how we found this out later after the fact was they got ripped off. And my friend's like, I don't know how we got ripped off that much because like when we did the valuation, we didn't have that money. And I'm like, yeah, you did. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, you had the money because she stole it. Like, it's not like she stole cold, hard cash. Like it wasn't in the numbers. And I mean, I know the whole family. I don't want to cause any sort of rift, but I'm kind of like, your brother gave the valuation on a lower number. Do you not realize that? Mm-hmm. And she just kind of like, it finally clicked. And she's like, he's always been a little sketch. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, you think, mm-hmm. But it was, they were trying to do the right thing and they have a good relationship. So what if you have not a great relationship with the buyer and the seller?
Right.
Like, you know, there's a lot of different ways things can go badly.
No, I agree. And, you know, like we talked before, we do a lot of work as the one expert for partnership disputes, divorces, and things like that. But, you know, a lot of times the people will be like, well, how do I know that you aren't doing something for one side or the other? And I said, you know, you really do have to search out somebody who respects their reputation as number one. And I said, I got a lot of time left in this game. And so I'm not going to ruin my reputation so that you get $20,000 more or $100,000 or $1 million, because I don't know you guys. And I'm trying to do the best work I have, but I also know that a lot of business owners will take that valuation and have somebody look at it. You know, so I'm trying to prove to the person that you're not telling me you're showing it to. I'm trying to prove to that person that I did it right. Not you, because you don't, you know, the people sometimes don't understand it. But I'm assuming you're going to hand it to your brother's cousin sister who did one valuation and took a valuation class 8 years ago. But they're going to look at it and they're going to look for key factors, you know, that are just egregious. And so, but the problem is hiring one expert in some capacity comes back to a little bit of trust. And again, what do we know about trust?
Not an internal control.
Right. And it isn't. And so you really have to be careful who you work with and or have a backup plan. You know, like I always tell people, if somebody that's not you wants to pay for the valuation, let them do it. Tell them to give it to you. And then you take that valuation to somebody else and have them look at it. Now, if they look at it and say, that's crazy, then that's when you'll trigger, oh, wait, I do want my own valuation person. I'm going to go get that valuation person and we're going to present a different valuation. And then you're kind of negotiating between those two valuations. And, you know, we get involved with that where we're the third valuator and we're coming in to say, okay, did these two people get it right or not? But now you're three in, right? And that's what a lot of operating agreements talk about is to do that process. But I think you got to be, I mean, in all of this, I think you got to be careful. And it's whether did they know that fraud was happening and just didn't talk, you know, was it that person that was doing the fraud? You know, it's sort of like when you protest too much, you might want to take a second look there kind of thing, but I don't know.
Just, you know, you have a hip issue, you go to a doctor, do you take that doctor's opinion? I mean, I have a friend who like had a hip issue. She went to a doctor and the doctor's like, yeah, we're going to do surgery. She ends up going to like a special massage person. She's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I so like it pays to get a second opinion a lot mm-hmm. of times, like, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. And sometimes you just don't need to do it all up in front. You can like, oh yeah, sure. Show me your evaluation first. Okay. Thanks. You know, cause from a negotiation standpoint as well, you show me that valuation first. I'm ahead of the game by understanding where you came in and go from there. But anyway, we get distracted. So, we have talked, you have Pink Collar Crime. So tell people more about how they could hire you, what types of things you really do for business owners. We're going to include all of your contact information and stuff like that. We also have pinkcollarcrime.com where they can reach you. But why would they hire you? Like, what would they see happening? Would they like see something happening, or are you going to be preventative, or tell me more?
So I primarily teach and train on pink collar crime and also ethics because, you know, tone at the top and that, all that sort of thing. And then COVID hit. And so I'm still doing like presentations online. And in the past, I've taught my peers, like, you know, other CFEs, auditors, accountants about pink collar crime. But at the end of last year, I was like, I can teach my peers, or I can teach the business owners who really are the ones who need to know this stuff. Because like, you know, that like you said earlier, mail your bank statements home. Now, a lot of business owners don't know that that's like one of the easiest freebies out there to prevent fraud. And so I primarily speak and train, and, you know, I speak to business owner groups. Like this week, I'm speaking to a bunch of public utilities. So I do that. And then I also consult. Because of COVID and everything, when I'm hired as a private investigator / certified fraud examiner, I'm always hired via attorney because there's attorney-client privilege and my work product could be protected. Depending where you're located, I may or may not be able to do the investigation, but I'm also like the fraud connector. If it's not a good fit for me, I'm going to guarantee you that I will find the good fit for you. So I'm kind of like this fraud matchmaker. but I do consulting. And again, if you get ripped off, like your first call should really be to your attorney. But if your attorney is like a business transaction attorney, that's not the right person for you. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of like, you know, victims, and they're like, well, can my attorney just do it? And I'm like, well, do you want your attorney to learn on your dime? No, like there's attorneys out there that are CFEs. So yeah, if you have any questions, the easiest thing to do is to reach out to me and I can tell you whether we're a fit or we're not. And if we're not, I'm going to find the person for you. But there's a lot of stuff you can do on the front end to make your case like good for law enforcement, if that's what you want. And some people are going to say, hey, I mean, I had a woman about 2 months ago, and she was the victim of a serial grifter, like a serial pink collar criminal. And how I knew this was she kept the dollar amount low. When the woman turned her into law enforcement immediately said, this is civil. And then the suspect literally tried to get the business owner. She filed a complaint that she bounced a check and that she was causing fraud. And I'm like, based on a lot of the circumstances, I was like, this is a serial grifter. She'll keep it under a certain amount. The cops are never going to be interested in her. So there's some talking through that like is part of consulting that will save you time, money, and energy in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Because I don't think there's a one way to deal with fraud in a business. And that's the hard part is it's not like this is committed and now we do these 18 steps and everything is solved. You know, it really is it's sort of like multiple forks in the road at every single decision-making process that And it's, you know, getting somebody involved, whether you're proactive about fraud in your business or whether you're reactive about fraud in the business, you don't know what you should be looking for. You don't know what you should not be touching. You don't know how to, you know, so I think that that's where somebody like you would come in to just say, okay, I don't know where to go from here. And I need to know if there's a roadmap to some sort of resolution or if I should just back up and say, okay, now that this happened, how do I prevent it from happening? And, or, you know, because I don't know, I just don't always see people getting prosecuted. You know, it's more often that they're like, especially if they're a government agency or a school, we see a lot of schools with the PTA funds and the, you know, because that's a lot of cash. So I'm collecting $20 from all these parents. And then, oh man, that never made it to the little hopper. So
that's one of the things that I also say is, you know, money is replaceable. You can always sell more widgets, you know, fundraise more, sell more of your time. But the trust is so much harder to get. And like a school, say a school club gets ripped off and you have like, how old are your kids?
All over the place, between 5 and 18.
Okay. So can you imagine telling, like, just say your 10-year-old, you know, that nice lady who works at the concession stands? Well, you know what? She stole from the school and you can't go to Washington, D.C. for your summer trip. That's a really hard lesson for a kid to learn at age 10 or at any age. And people like you can get the money back, whether insurance, you know, sell more, whatever. But that trust that you lose, that when I meet someone, I met a guy a while ago, and when he found out what I did, he immediately went back 20 years and told me his whole story of how he got ripped off $37,000, not 30, not 40, 37,000. It is just, it's haunting. It's like, I mean, my house was robbed when I was in my 20s twice. And like, it's haunting. And this is haunting, especially because these people worked really closely with you. The woman who stole $1 million from the dentist, she went to all of the dentist family functions for, you know, over 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was crushing to them. And they were the nicest couple on the planet. Oh my God. He goes, I would have given her the money.
But that's the problem, is that this is not the exception to the rule. This is the rule. It is more often than not the most trusted advisor, the old gray-haired lady that was doing the books for 35 years, that, you know, something happened, something snapped or whatever, she deserved it. I don't know. But I think that that's what business owners need to understand, is they're not going to show up looking all shady and like, I'm here to take your money. You know, they're going to show up kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing, and you're not going to know, and you're not even going to think. You know, we were talking earlier that when I did work with my family, and they were like, oh, you can sign things, you can have access to the bank accounts, you're a signer, you did. And I was like, no. And they're like, but we trust you. And I was like, no, this is what the problem is that I would be the most likely to steal from you. He's like, but you wouldn't do that. And I was like, no, I wouldn't do that. But if you're willing to let me take 1, 2, 3 too many steps, right, of control, what are you willing to do to somebody else? I'm like, this is just a lesson. I'm just trying to help you for other people, right? Yeah. But that's the big thing, because not all families are the same. I've seen a ton of families that have run businesses that there is one person that kind of thought they got screwed, or they, you know, dad was never really nice to me. I was always the black sheep, and they're like, I'm going to get them back.
Oh yeah. Oh. Yeah.
And that happens all the time.
So many stories. We could go for hours for the stories of family embezzlers and family dysfunction. Right. Like, I mean, honestly, it's and spouses. Like,
yeah.
I was riding the ski lift a couple of years ago, two dentists, a father and a son dentist. And they ask what I do. And I tell them, and you know, the father's quiet, so I know it's happened to him. The son's like, well, you know, my wife, she does my books. And I just smile. In the last 2 years, I've had two dentist spouses, one male, one female, both steal, now ex-spouses. But it's like, you don't know what's going to happen in someone's life. Like, I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm never going to cross that line. But I have children. And, you know, I can't swear 100% because you don't know what's coming down the road. You truly, truly don't know what's coming down the road. So, and good people make bad choices. Bad people make good choices. We mm-hmm. don't always stay in that lane that we think we're in.
Well, and sometimes it's one bad choice, but you can never fix it. So you have to continue, you kind of continue it to try to cover it. And that's yep. another hard pit. So two more things that I want to cover before you leave. One is you have a podcast.
Great Women in Fraud.
Great Women in Fraud. We got that up there. Okay. Awesome. The second is, can we talk about something that you're going to be releasing this year?
Ooh, yeah, my book. Oh my God. I'm so excited. This is like, I've been told so many times to write a book. And then finally, like 2 years ago, I got really serious about it. COVID, really, really serious. And it should be done by like next week. And it's called Embezzlement, How to Prevent, Detect, and Investigate Pink Collar Crime.
Nice.
So yeah, I would have loved to have done Catch Me If You Can, Today's Pink Collar Criminal, but with the way Amazon is, you've got to do SEO. So it's kind of sounds boring, but it's like the reviews I've been getting have been just heartfelt because I make it relatable. Like these are all stories that I know about, I've investigated, or, you know, I've read about, and they are all relatable. So yeah, my book, it'll be out soon.
Awesome. Well, we will update all of this for links to the book and all things linking to you. We really appreciate it. I know we've covered a lot of topics. It kind of flew by. But who knows? Maybe after the book in the new year, we got to come back and talk about more topics. So
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Kelly. And we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Melissa.